Okay. Okay, today is Tuesday, February 11th, 2014. This is Patrick Callahan with the Westchester Public Library. Also present is Fidencio Marbella, Library Director. Today we'll be speaking with Mr. Cruz. Mr. Marvin Cruz served 3 years in the United States Army in World War II. This interview is being conducted for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress. Okay, Mr. Cruz, why don't we go ahead and get started? Why don't you tell me about when and where you were born, about growing up.
Okay, I was born in March 7, 1922 in the Springs. And I went to school in the Springs, and I graduated from Maine Township High School. And then when the war started, I was afraid it would be ended before I could get in. And I did. So I went down to the Navy, and they wouldn't take me at that time because I wore glasses. But later on, they changed it. But so I said, well, I'll go to the Army, of course. They took you. So,
oh, okay.
So I went to the Army.
Okay.
And so I volunteered for that, and basically I stayed in it for 3 years.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Now, before we started the interview, you mentioned you had an uncle who served.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And he was a veteran of
World War One. Yeah.
Okay.
And he told me stories about it, and I was always intrigued by his stories, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
he made an influence on me, probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So then you enlisted then.
Yeah.
You weren't drafted. You enlisted in 1942.
42.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about that? When you enlisted?
Well, let's see now. Well, like I said, I wanted to go into the Navy, but I wore glasses, so they rejected me. If I would have waited, they changed that law. But at first, you couldn't wear glasses, you know. But then later on, as long as they're correctable, you know. So,
okay.
So I went to the Army. Of course, they had no qualms. Oh, sure, you know.
Okay.
So they took you with open arms. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, did you immediately go for training, your basic training?
Okay, they had basic training, which was basically infantry.
Infantry
is the queen of battle, you know. Everybody, they were supposed to, I mean, I read somewhere, when the war started, they figured the United States would need 100 divisions before the war would end. They had about 75 when the war ended, so they were building up to 100 divisions. And so you had your basic infantry training, and then, you know, then you specialize, and they had regimental combat teams.
Okay.
And that was really the fighting unit, regimental combat team. So you were assigned to some regiment, and you fought with them. They had everything: infantry, tanks, artillery. They were a combat team, and they were good. So we ended up in a regimental combat.
Okay. How long was basic training?
It was supposed to be 13 weeks, but they cut it down to, I think, 6 weeks.
Oh,
because,
okay,
you know, they needed you. There's war going on. They needed you. They couldn't wait to get more training. But you mm-hmm. you did pretty good on that.
Okay. And where was your basic training?
Let's see. I had it in Camp Livingston, Louisiana.
Okay.
And that was it there. And let's see. Something else happened. After you go through this training, and there's some of us were left. I thought, oh, my gosh, I must have failed, you know, basic training. But they'd call off names. They'd go to different artillery, infantry, artillery, quartermaster. I said, I'm left here yet, and I ended up in the medics. So never thought about the medics, you know. So I ended up as a combat medic. Yeah.
Okay.
So just the way ball bounces, I guess. I think the day you go in service determines where you're going to go.
Okay.
A friend of mine came in a week later, he went to the Air Force. Somebody, you know, so I think that's what they do. The day you go in is your determines. Yeah.
Okay, and did you go through any specialized training to be a medic?
To be a medic?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. We were told to stop hemorrhaging, when somebody, you know, stop hemorrhaging, get them out of line of fire, carry them back, and prevent shock. Shock is very important. I mean,
yeah.
Everybody, you get injured, person goes into shock. I mean, it's natural. Everybody has it. So those are things we try to prevent, yeah.
Okay. So how long after, you said that your basic training, the period of basic training was shortened, were you just immediately deployed after that, at the conclusion of basic training?
Because we're ready to make the invasion.
Okay.
You know, we're going to invade France.
Okay.
So I found out later, we were a second wave. It takes about 5 days for a division to land because they got 14,000 troops coming in. It takes 5 days. Then the next division comes in because, you know, it's own. Overnight because you got to take all these landing crafts to get in. So we happened to be in the 29th Division, the 28th Division. I think the second, you know, whoever follows us, however it's appointed to go. I still know who appoints you, but somewhere in the War Department, your unit is tag, go, you know. Yeah.
Were you given any kind of leave between basic... basic training and when you were deployed, or were you just immediately?
You're supposed to get 30 days furlough a year. I got one furlough in 3 years. After that, I went overseas, and that was it, you know. So supposed to be 30, but I got one. I got home once in 3 years. Yeah.
So could you tell us a little bit about what the voyage was like from the United States to Europe?
Okay, let's see. I think it took 10 days. We're in a convoy, and the convoy, I'm surprised, it's sideways. I thought they lined up, but the ships are all together. The main troops are in the middle, and they got supply on, in case they get, you know, submarines and stuff that try to protect the troops, of course, and supplies, you know, they can sink them, So there's always an alert for that, you know, but I don't think we're fired on by a submarine, yeah.
So where did you arrive in Europe? Where did you first step foot?
I think it was Bristol, and we're coming into the shore, you know, to the docks, and the people would come in all, and we got fruit every day in the army. Man, so it was your fruit, you know. So we had an orange and so on. But that's the last I saw for an orange in 3 years. I can see why people wanted to get those oranges. They were scared, so, because we thought we'd have it every day, but, you know, then we found out that there's a war going on. So that was good. So, we landed over there, and we landed, and we had a pamphlet, you know, Churchill welcomes us, you know, and in it, by the way, there was a condom.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that condom was in my pocket for a long time. Because later on, when you come to think of it, you went for a pass, you had to show that, you know, that you had protection.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you're you're supposed to be ready for combat all the time. And if you're not there, I mean, you know, you're a casualty. So you make sure that, you know, that you're protected on it. So I can see it now, but at that time I thought it was silly, but...
A letter from Winston Churchill on a condom.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Little pamphlet, welcome, you know.
Okay, and then from Bristol, where did we go?
We put on a train, went out to Wales.
Okay.
Country, you know, we had Quonset huts, army huts that the British had better made. So we continued our training out there, and then later on we moved closer, getting ready for making D-Day. We moved back into closer to England, so we'd get on a train and get on a ship so we could land in England. So that was pretty good. It worked out pretty well. Yeah.
Okay. Now, did Normandy come next?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, like I say, we were supposed to land the second wave, which is the next division. The 29th Division was ahead of us, and then we came in the 28th Division, And I think the second division followed us, you know, but I say it takes 5 days for the division to completely unload because of all the, you know, you had a landing craft, you know, there's no piers, so you had to walk in water and, you know, and that was okay there, you know. So.
What was it like? I mean, arriving there.
Well, when we left, we were doing our training in the United States, and we were alerted. I said, "Okay, we're alerted. We're going to go overseas. We can't tell you where you're going, but we can tell you the people are friendly." Well, in England, you know, that means we're going to go to England. See, so that's how we went over. So we landed in England, and I think it was they had a convoy, you know, zigzag about 10 days to get there. So we got there. It was pretty nice then, The English were pretty nice. We liked it. They had a system. They'd line up for things, and it's so much more efficient. You wait for a bus, you wait for a bus. Next person, he'll wait for a bus. First thing, you've got a line. The bus comes, everybody goes aboard. Not like over here, where it makes a mad dash, you know, and knock each other out of the way. So that was one custom that I noticed that was very, very good. Yeah. I wish they could do that more over in this country.
I guess I was arriving in Normandy, though.
Okay. Right.
I mean, how did you feel? What was that like?
Well, okay. So we had a jump. We had a troop ship. You know, it was a troop ship at that time was the ones that made cross invasion, you know, civilians across from England over to France. You know, it's like a ship in the Great Lakes here or something like that. So we went aboard that. And then when it was time to jump, it was my turn to jump. So we had to jump down from the deck into the landing craft. And the landing craft, you know, is where it holds about 40 people. You make a landing and the ramp drops and you walk ashore. So, it's made a steel and they had a rope coil. So I'm being short. I said, I'll wait till it comes up, so far to jump, you know, but you're in the bow of the ship, you know, but of course it's crooked. So I jumped into that, and boom, I fell. Good thing I fell in, but I sprained my ankle. I mean, boy, And so, man, then we landed, I had to grab a hold of a couple of guys around their neck and hobble ashore because, you know, I couldn't walk, and I got up by a cliff, and I dug a foxhole. A medical officer came out, he says, you only got a sprained ankle, you can stay here, you know, because the serious ones, they're going to put them back, you know, taking the ones back to the hospital. So I just had to lay there for about 3 or 4 days and
watch
the war go by.
Really?
People come ashore and I'm still waiting to walk. And finally I could walk. So I went up to an MP. I said, where's the 28th Division? Well, you'll find it. It had Keystone. You'll find it. So I finally got back to my old outfit again. And that's it. I got back just in time to, you know, go back into combat.
So were you saying you were in the foxhole for three or four days?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Things are going around you and explosion. Most injuries are caused by artillery and mortar fire.
Okay.
Not rifle bullets because, you know, bigger radius when they throw mortars at you. Mortars are, you know, those are the things that get you.
Huh.
Yeah. So not the other, because they're better radius, you know, yeah.
Okay. How long after D-Day did you land? Did you arrive?
Well, probably 5 days.
5 days,
yeah. Yeah, 5 days, because we had to wait for the other division, and then we came. Okay. Because, you know, so I call it the second wave. Well, it was the second division. Another division was ahead of us, so we followed them, and they have almost so much room before they can unload the landing craft and get some more people. Everything which had to be on, you know, on landing craft because there's no piers or anything. So.
And then, so then after you recovered from your injury, did you just immediately get to work?
Oh, yeah. I remember I came back and I reported to my sergeant, you know, and they said, oh, good, because down here there's a half track. It was a half track is sort of like a half tank. It's got wheels, and instead of wheels, it's got track on it, you know.
Uh-huh.
It's got wheels, you can steer it, but it can go over rougher terrain. And they said it just got hit, and there's a couple of people, you know, go down and get them. You know, so, okay, we'll go down and get the ones that got hit yet. There's still some wounded down there. So we go walking down the thing. I mean, now we're in combat, Michael, here. We come walking down there, and, man, just as we got down there, sure enough, there was a guy in a machine gun opened fire. Just ricocheted right over our heads, you know. So we just thought, they probably thought, these guys are, think they're God or what, walking like, coming down here, right in the line of fire. So we quick, you know, we never walked like that again. And how you go, crawl and you crouch, you didn't walk, stand up and go on. When you're fighting, you're not standing. Because we all thought when a bullet left the enemy's gun, it had your name on it, see? But the ones you're worried about, to whom it may concern. That's, that's the one. So we learn about that. So never want to do like that again. But you learn that. I mean, why? Quick lesson.
I'm just curious. Was there anything indicating that you're a medic on your... are you wearing like...
Oh, we had a Red Cross on our helmet.
Okay.
And we also had an armband.
Okay.
And those were recognizable. And most of the time, the enemy would recognize it, you know.
Did they have any respect
for
that?
Yeah, I think sometimes they shot at you, but sometimes it was an accident, you know. Like I say, you're shooting everybody, you know, man, you're an enemy, you know, so yeah. So I always felt safer, like when we were in Normandy. You know, we've done foxholes, you know, because at nighttime and they keep shelling, you know, and you take your Red Cross off, and I stick it on a stick. I say, well, if they make a bane at it, maybe they won't do it because they see I'm a medic, you know, so not carrying a gun. Yeah, so I thought there was a little protection there by it, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it probably was. I mean, you know, but sometimes though I've seen guys too, they had a buddy shot and. They're bringing in prisoners, and this guy took a video, shut all the prisoners out. You know, the guy cracks up. Because they found out that the psychiatrist found out 200 days in combat's about it. That's about when everybody's going to crack up. They figure about 200 days in combat, and that's about your breaking point. So they tried to bring you out of combat. I mean, I was out 193 days. They brought me out of combat, you know, see. So you don't crack up, because that's... You know, you see this movie, Pat, you know, where he slapped some guys. Well, these guys were combat exhaustion, you know. They weren't cowards, they were combat exhaustion. And you hear guys, well, I've heard a guy too, when you get hit, they call mother. They call for their mother. You know, they think they're their mother. And then they call for a medic, you know. Yeah.
Is that, people that you were helping as a medic, were these people, I guess I'm trying to picture it, are people calling out for you, or are you being directed by other soldiers to injured?
Sometimes they give us a map, you know. Like one time there was an area, you couldn't go down the railroad track because it was mine, so you had to go down the road and find this road that went across the track. You wouldn't do that, so you'd try to stay out of, you know, areas that you knew were mine. And mines were pretty bad too. There's a lot of people got hurt and killed on mines. That was another major way of getting rid of the enemy. Yeah, or they get rid of you. Yeah. So yeah.
How many other were there other medics, or how many other medics were there? Did you guys work together?
Okay, we have four in the squad.
Okay.
Four in the squad, and you're normally the same height, because some guys short, some guys tall. It's hard to carry a person, you know, you're...
Really?
So you try to keep... You know, our squad was all little, see? Our squad was all so young. Little ones, you know, see? Of course, we had one disadvantage by being little, too.
What?
But we freighted through France. You know, we freighted...
Oh.
So all the tall guys were in the front, and us little guys were in the back. This one girl come up to me and she grabs hold of me. Come on, you know.
And that's in Paris.
Paris, yeah. So we went to her place, had some champagne, and we have some advantages too.
Okay. Great time.
So It's not all.
No.
Everything from Tom Adams. Some guys have it too. Yeah, sure.
So there was four, you and three others, or you and four others?
Four in the squad.
Four in the squad.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it worked pretty good. Worked pretty good. Yeah.
Okay.
See, now also, the combat medics got paid just like the combat infantry. The only ones got paid the infantry, they got $10 pay. But the combat medics got $10 also. Because, but artillery didn't get it, you know, but only the ones who actually were in combat, you know, got combat pay, $10 a month. At that time, it was World War II, $10 was $10, yeah. You go in, your base pay is $50, you know, $50 a month. Then you got the PFC, you got $54, you know. Then you got $10 for being in combat, and you know, so first thing you know, you had $70. So that was good pay, you know, back those days, yeah.
When there was like a lull in combat, as a medic, were you still attending to injured soldiers, or?
Well, what do you mean when between?
When there was like a lull in the combat.
Well,
I mean,
we kept on training. Kept right on training. Oh, idleness. They didn't want you idle.
No.
You know, they want you always to do something. You had to be training, and come on, we're going to do some calisthenics. We're going to do this. We're going to go some classes, you know. So they never let you be idle, because you start thinking, hey, we got it rough here. They don't want you to think that.
No.
So I can understand that, you know, yeah. So I can understand it now, yeah.
So how long were you in Normandy then?
Well, okay, we landed in Normandy. And finally, let's see, they broke through. You know, they broke the line, and we couldn't keep on. So they had a set period, I don't know exact time, but the Army said, okay, anybody who was in Normandy at this period of time, this is when the war was going on, and you were entitled to get a Bronze Star, for your ETO ribbon, you get it. And then they go to the next campaign. So there was five campaigns in Europe during the whole war, five campaigns, and it tells you what ones they were. They had certain periods of time. So there were five major battles in Europe during that time, you see them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. What was it like in northern France? In northern France?
Well, we were moving. So when you're moving, you feel a little better than when you're static. I mean, you have a chance to progress and to look for a place to sleep. You always try to get a building. Try to get a building, a barn, something, you know. So you don't want to lay out in the winter time in the snow. You'll try to find a building, a haystack or something, a barn or something. Yeah, so you always look for a place for shelter, yeah.
Okay.
Because you can't dig a foxhole, it's too frozen snow, yeah.
Yeah, I always wonder about the comfort level. It's just like seeing films and reading about war. Just like, you know, how much sleep are you getting?
Okay,
like,
for example, now you need a shower. They put you on a truck, and they'd go back some distance, and they'd have a quartermaster. They'd have water from the river or stream, and they said, okay, you take off all your clothes, you're going to keep your boots. Boots you always kept. But other uniforms, you got new dirty uniforms, they give you what they call Class B, which means they were not torn or ripped or something, but they didn't have all their tags on. They were comfortable. You could go right into them. So they'd turn on the water for so many seconds, you know, rinse, and then they'd turn it on. Okay, water's going to be on for the next 20 seconds, you know, now you're rinsed, you know. So that's how we took showers, you know. Mm-hmm. And it worked out pretty good, you know, because it's limited hot water, limited, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Man, so. Yes. Okay, and then came the, is it Ardennes?
Ar-
Ardennes.
Ardennes?
Okay, the Battle of the Bulge, yeah.
That came next?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we were in this one town, and in the morning, we actually stepped into a building, and we throw our blankets onto a, it was like a two-story hotel, we throw our blankets on there, and then every morning you come out for reveille, you know, make sure you're present, and you do calisthenics. So we came out one morning, we came out for that, and boom, boom, they start shelling us. The Battle of Bulge started. Well, they thought they were shelling us, you know. We're out there doing it, and some of the buildings are being hit, you know, and, you know, what's going on here? We're still doing it. Then we found out it was, then we found out they were making an attack on us, of course. And that's scary, too. You're out there and see these gray uniforms, you know, and enemies approaching, you know, coming out, oh, boy, you know.
Yeah.
So you're getting pretty well confused, scared. I mean, you know, I don't know what how to explain it, but, you know, not knowing what's going on, so, you know. But that was good because sometimes, like say when I was captured, they'd ask you, well, you don't know the plan, so, well, you know, you're not important. They want to know what's going on. Well, I was only a pre-FC, you know, I was following orders from my corporal, you know, yeah, so.
Yeah, you had mentioned that before we started the interview, that you were captured and released twice.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that occur?
That was in Germany, right in Germany, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We're carrying a wounded back, and a patrol comes up there, you know, and, you know, drop your litter, and come and see, you know, we came with him, you know, went to a farmhouse or some kind of building, and an officer could speak English, you know, asking us what's going on, trying to get information from us. Of course, we were only supposed to tell him our name, rank, and serial number. He said, well, that's all we know, you know, and we only know, we don't know what's going on, we don't know the plan, which we didn't. They don't tell us what's going on in the war,
right.
The overall plans, but we know we're here, and you're there. I mean, that's all we know. Our war is what we see, not what's going on someplace else. So, when they interviewed us, they didn't really, you know. Because we were told before we landed that the German army knew all the officers' names. They knew who was in command of the division, which they probably did. You know, they probably knew the generals and stuff like that. So
being a medic then, in a situation like that, were you not really that scared? I mean, did you expect to be released, or?
I didn't expect to be released, no. But scared, well, yeah, you're always sort of scared, yeah. You know, you always don't know what's going to go on, or if today's, I never thought I was going to come out alive, really. I thought, today I'm going to get killed. Today I'm going, I always had that feeling, today's my last day, you know.
Oh.
Yeah. And I always prayed for the people who were going to get killed that day. You know, I know the guy next to you is going to get killed, or next, you know, that's just the way it is. You just have casualties, yeah. So.
Did, when they released you, did they say why they let you go?
Yeah, they said you're more important doing what you're doing than to be in a PW camp, which we were. Because we'd pick up Germans, civilians, Americans, whoever got hit, we weren't. You know, we weren't that fussy about, we're going to save lives.
They
asked me one time I come back, did you ever kill anybody? I said, I hope not. I was saving people. I said, I wasn't killing people. So we had morphine. Oh, morphine, that's another thing, we had morphine. You come up to a fellow, you know, you first thing you know, you want to stop his bleeding, you know, and next thing he had pain. So we had a first aid kit, and it was a nice pair of sharp scissors. You could cut, you know, and then you could give them a shot of morphine. And it was a quarter grain. And you take the thing and bend the point over, so when they got back to where there's medical supplies, they wouldn't give them another shot of morphine.
They would see that they had already
That's
had
right.
morphine.
Otherwise, okay. You give it two shots of half a grain of morphine, it'll kill you, but a quarter grain won't. But these guys are in pain, you know, you had to do that. And so you had to try to let them know when they got back to them. Back to the headquarters, you know, where they already had some morphine. Because morphine was wicked stuff, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that, yeah. They told us not to, you know, be careful with it, which we were.
Mm-hmm.
We could get all the morphine we had because that was our way of treating soldiers, you know.
Okay.
Our pouch always carried morphine.
Okay. Any individual soldiers or casualties that kind of stick out in your mind?
Well, there was a fellow named Eddie Slovak. He was the only man executed by American troops during World War II. Did you ever hear that story, Eddie Slovak? Yeah. So he was in my company, yeah.
He was in your company?
Yeah. He was trying to be, but he ran away before he got there.
Did you ever know him?
I knew of him. I seen him, yeah. He was supposed to fight, and he threw his rifle down. I'm not fighting, you know. So I said, you're going back in there. I'm not fighting. He threw his rifle down, you know. And he got the death sentence to be shot by American troops. And by gosh, they shot him. I remember a chaplain called us together one day. He said, I just witnessed this most disgraceful thing in my life. He said, I saw one of our men get shot by a bunch of our men. You know, that's good for desertion. But the funny part, his story, he was a sort of a petty thief. I mean, he had a record of, you know, juvenile, and he never should have been in the army to begin with. You know, he was not desirable. You don't want guys like that fighting. You know, and he was fighting, and he was not. You wouldn't want him, and he was shot, executed him. You know, there's a book about him, movie about him, mm-hmm. Saving Private Eddie Slovak. Yeah.
Just forgive me for a second. I thought in situations like that, did they have the option of court-martialing or executing them?
Yeah, right. They thought we had and put in prison, and then you're out after war's over, see? But wow. Somehow it all passed. Well, I approve. And it got by Eisenhower, and all of a sudden, man, wow. They were seriously shot him. They thought he could get, you know, just some prison time and be done with it, see? But he didn't get it, yeah.
My goodness. Yeah. And he was in your company, you
said. Yeah, I knew him. Well, I mean, I've seen him, you know.
Okay. Yeah. So you're familiar with him.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else, any other individual soldiers or casualties that stick out at all that you recall?
Well, the first guy got hit was the biggest guy. Yeah, Hardy was his name. He's the first guy that got hit was the big guy, so. But that was just coincidence, you know. Anybody could be hit, you know.
Yeah.
You know. But, so that, remember that, yeah. You know.
Okay. Okay. And so after Ardennes, you're in Rhineland?
In Rhineland, yeah.
Yeah.
Battle of the Bulge, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then.
And they put us back to regroup, you know. Then they had another battle, man. They just put the Hurtgen Fort. That was just as bad as the. They had an area you could go through this woods or go around it. And the American Army, they were told to go through it. That was a silly thing to do. Here we got tanks and artillery, and we went through the Hurtgen Fort instead of bypassing it. So that was a bad decision by some higher up general who didn't know what was going on. It should never have been fought, the Battle of Hurtgen Fort. And we lost. And other divisions, same thing. We lose all their men there. You know, we got so depleted. When you go in combat, you get extra troops. You get about 20% extra. You go through a battle, you feel you're going to lose 20% of your men. So we always knew we were going to be alerted for another attack. All of a sudden, the first sergeant brings in some more men, and that means we're going to make an attack tomorrow or very soon. And sure enough, you know, then after that, then they take the excess and then, you know, then we go back to normal strength. So we'd have extra strength when you attack. Yeah.
How long were you in Hurtgen Forest?
Hurtgen Forest.
Hurtgen Forest.
Oh, gosh. Probably 2 weeks. Everybody in there got slaughtered. 8th Division, 28th, everybody within that got slaughtered, yeah. Because I know one time, I think it was in there, I'm in my foxhole, and one morning another sergeant come, hey, so you're being relieved. So I rolled out of mine and gave it to another soldier. He took over 8th Division. They took over our spot, and we got somewhere else. So we physically just gave them our position because they're trying to get through. And every division was hurt bad. It should have been fought through. Too many tree bursts, artillery bursts. That's where all the casualties are coming from, artillery. Hit a tree and a big area would be surrounded, not just the land, you know, but, well, sometimes too, the land, but the ground would take some of it. But sometimes, you know, tree bursts were very, very, very bad. Could spray more area. One shell could maybe knock out 15 guys. That's 15 guys, you know, in a big area. And the shrapnel, you know, and then, of course, you had to get evacuated, get shrapnel in them, you know. So it was bad. Hurt before it was bad. Shouldn't have been there.
2 weeks.
Yeah. Should have gone the way it should go, not the way somebody says it should go. Yeah. Bad leadership, yeah.
Okay. And then Central Europe came after Rhineland?
Yeah, because when you're advancing, then the army says, okay, now that's the end of that theater. That was, next one is this one. A certain time period, you know, when you're advancing this, so that's how you get your different battles.
Okay.
The government decides which was the time period and where you were. And if you were in that area, you were, you know, you were considered part of that, and you'd get it was a Bronze Star for Bronze Battle Star. Yeah.
Okay. Were you ever wounded or injured?
Well, like I said,
the ankle,
but it was later I found out it was broken.
Oh man.
That's why I got a bad limp today.
Did you have, the whole time you were in Europe, did you have chronic pain?
Oh, yeah. Over there? Yeah, but that's part of life.
Oh, my goodness.
Part of life, yeah. You just go along with it, yeah. So, I still got a big swell on my ankle yet, you know. I should have got a Purple Heart, but never did. It was, you know, I considered Purple Hearts when you actually get hit, you know, not when you get hurt. Yeah. But your casualties, you know, your casualties, you can't do anything, you know, because.
I guess I forgot to ask you before, was your second time being captured and released very similar to the first time?
Yeah.
Basically the same type of thing where they questioned you and.
Yeah, questioning went back, And then people would, like I say, they'd surrender to you. The other people come up to you because you bring a bunch of soldiers with you, and the German prisoners, they're not going to be shot because they see you walking with them, so they surrender to you because you know you're a safe haven as far as being shot at, you know. So yes, you captured. I mean, they would surrender to you because of your situation for their safety. Yeah.
Right.
So.
Another thing that I'm curious about is, did you know how long you were going to be over there?
Hmm.
Now, I know some soldiers, when they're deployed, they're counting down the days.
Duration plus 6 months.
Oh, okay.
Duration of the war plus 6 months. That's forever.
Yeah.
Thought the war would never end. Oh, my gosh. And this war is never going to end, you know.
And that's
and what I... must feel they're the only one fighting. Where's everybody else fighting? Hey, where are everybody else? We're fighting. Where's the rest of the army?
And also what you said earlier, I mean, every day you're thinking is your last day.
That's right, sure.
And you don't know when you're ever
going
home.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah. So.
I could see why at that 200-day mark a lot of people would...
Sure. Oh, yeah. That was a breaking point, yeah. So... And I guess it worked out pretty good. Yeah.
So when did you know? When did you know you were leaving Europe?
Well, let's see. Well, now see, they had a point system. You got the war in Europe was ended, so they counted every point that you were in service, every point overseas. 5 points for every battle you were in, 5 points for every decoration, and 12 points if you had children.
Hmm.
You know, so I'm counting out my points, and I've got 83 points. I needed 85. I'm 2 points shy of going out, you know. So, but then the war in Europe ended. Then they counted points to you know, till that time. So it gave me 5 more points. I got 88. I'm going to be discharged. I don't have to go to Japan because we were slated to go to Japan then. But if you had enough points, you could get out, you know, could be discharged. And, but actually, married men always tried to give the married men the breaks. You know, they'd make them truck drivers or, you know, because then they were assigned a little more safety. And they figured, you know, a married man is more important than a single man. I don't know how they figured that, but, you know, but they did. They did give, and that was all right. We went along with that. The guy's got a family. He's married, you know, so we never questioned that, why they got the best jobs. And, well, the safest jobs, let's say, you know, driving it. Because your vehicle was more important than you, you know. Vehicle, you know, you know, you could always be replaced, but they couldn't always get another truck. They'd have another guy drafted to follow you. But if you lose a truck or something, they're going, where are you going to get it? You got to go through our chain of command to try to replace it. So I thought that you always had people coming in.
So did you celebrate when you heard that the war was over?
Oh, yeah. Let's see. How did we celebrate? Yeah, we celebrated. Oh, yeah. Now, it was, you could always find wine, champagne. You could always find liquor. I don't know why. It was every farmhouse had it, you know. Fellas would fill up their canteen. Never a shortage of alcoholic beverages. Never. Well, everybody made it, everybody had it in the houses, and yeah. And the guys are going to, most guys are look for something to drink, or women. I mean, that's a true thing, you know. So liquor was available, so they went for that, of course. You know, yeah. See, prostitution was legal in France, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. I know we come in there and say, now don't you GIs spoil it. It used to cost 40 cents, 20 francs, you know, 22 cents. You could have a prostitute for 40 cents. Now, don't go spoil it and give them a dollar or something. So, and then they had the blacks were allowed a certain, you know, we were not integrated in World War II, you know. Mm-hmm. And the blacks could have their section, the whites would have their section. So, we didn't have a trouble with it. But, we didn't see blacks, and, you know, they were not in combat. It seemed like they never. They were not put in combat like whites, you know. I don't know why, but somehow they. Well, later on, I was in the headquarters company, and they tried to put you by your IQ. They knew all the smart people in one company, you know. You take an IQ test, you know.
Mm-hmm.
114. Well, 114 was the minimum. 114 means you're a little higher than under that. So they try to put so many men in this company, so all the smart men wouldn't go in one company. The officer would pick out all, you know, so they try to balance it out. So, because the smarter you are, it seems like the more level-headed you are, you know. It seems like you can understand things a lot easier if you know things instead of just. So I think the IQ means something, your IQ. Means something to a person.
Oh, okay. Did they, yeah, did, what kind of aptitude tests and earlier on when you were in training, what kind of aptitude tests?
You go in, the morning you go in, they give you all kinds of tests. You know what you're doing, they give you all kinds of tests. And some of that's IQ tests, and like I said, then you're put out in the depot, and then they take you from there, you know, so I see that they tried to level it out, so the companies were pretty well evenly distributed.
Okay. Now, after World War II, you re-enlisted?
Yeah. I felt I was in the best shape possible. Man, could do all kinds of exercise, you could run, you could fall, and you could do everything. I said, your best shape of your life is right after that. So I said, I'll join the reserves in case I get called back. I'll I'll be pretty good shape. So I joined the reserves, and I got called back. Yeah.
For Korea?
Yeah, yeah. Geez,
how old were you when you re-enlisted?
Probably 23, 24. I think 20 when I first went in. You know, then 3 years later, yeah, then I joined the reserves, yeah. So it was okay. I think it was a wise decision. I mean, I thought it was. I never regretted it. Yeah. So.
Okay. So what was, when you finally came back, okay, back to the United States, what was it like? I mean, how did you feel?
Oh, man, I'm glad to get back, you know, and it seemed, I remember the first day I came back, and I lived in the Plains. I came back on a train, and the first girl I happened to see happened to be this girlfriend of mine, sister. Oh, she said, bet she'd like to see you. I said, well, I'll see her tomorrow. I want to see my mother and father first, you know, see. So then I got back to see my old girlfriend. Yeah. Yeah, so that was good, you know. Mm. Yeah.
Didn't you guys celebrate with your family when you came back?
Oh, yeah, did that, yeah. Yeah, we moderation, no celebration, but, you know, so we were not heavy drinkers or stuff, you know, yeah.
I mean, they must have been... Everybody,
oh, gosh, yeah, you'd come back and you'd go to town. Oh, gosh, I happened to be the first one back. And I'd go to a place, they'd always give you drinks and come on, you know. And you know, so that was, you know, even got to go with a girl that was engaged to somebody else. And they thought I was engaged to her, you know. So, and she was a 6'1" girl. But she was just as proud as can be, I mean, you know. She'd walk with me in the place, you know, yeah, so. I enjoyed it, too, with a beautiful girl, you know. And she was, oh, she was a knockout. Oh, yeah. So, yeah. But she had an engagement ring and all, but, yeah. It was, sometimes things were worked out pretty good. Yeah.
So, after you came, well, here's just kind of a general question. What do you think... obviously you're in combat, but I mean, what do you make of military life? I mean, what do you make of your sort of whole experience?
I think I understood it. I understood why, you know. So it didn't bother me any, you know. You have all this chicken stuff going on, different rules and regulations, but they had to have something going on, you know. They couldn't make their own rules. They had to follow, you know, some kind of a regimen, you know, the way to keep going. So I never questioned that. So they must have a reason, and sometimes there were pretty good reasons. Most of the time were pretty good reasons. And they try to take care. And another thing, too, your officers played an important part. You know, officer, now that, you know, to be an officer, you have to have a college education, you know. So, okay, they're smarter, they understand more, and they watch you more. I mean, I think I owe a lot to my officers, because they would more or less try to protect you, because they would know how, they would understand it better, they'd know better, you know. So I always honored an officer, you know.
Okay. So the regimented life of the military, is that something you kind of took with you after you were done with your service? I guess that the whole kind of
Yeah, you sort of learn that there is a pretty good reason why some of these things happen. And you got to have some kind of control. I mean, you know, you have a speed sign. You got to have a speed sign, right? Everybody, you got to have speed. You got to have some kind of rules and regulations, even if they're not, you don't think they're silly, but.
Was there anything else? Do you have any final thoughts or anything else you wanted to add at all?
Well, I enjoy reading about the reserves coming back, you know, from Afghanistan, you know, in these places. So I can sort of relate to them somewhat.
Okay.
And so they have interesting stories, you know. Yeah. Everybody has a story. Everybody has a story to tell. Some are good, some are bad, some are mediocre, but that's the way it is. There's no such thing as being average. You're an average mm-hmm. statistic, but you're not average. You're an average statistic, yeah. So, yeah.
Okay. Anything else, or?
Well, I think now, during World War II, when troops had come back, the people would always welcome you, and I don't think they have that today. I don't think people, welcome the veterans back like they should, I mean, these guys had a job, and they're doing it, and I think they, just a little, just thank you, did a good job, just a little thing, we don't have to throw a big party or something, but I think returning veterans are not given an adequate return when they come back, adequate cooperation, because they're just like most everybody, they're told to do a job, and most of them do a good job, So
you don't think they get their due now?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. So you're not the first person who said that. Okay. Okay, well, if there's nothing else then, thanks for coming in and talking to us today,
right.
Sharing your memories.
Yeah. Okay.